This went on for some 10 minutes. Me just begging the guy to type an address into the computer. Just go in the back and, hell, I don't care if he just went back there and stood for 10 minutes. Just act like he did something. But alas, he just sat there and continued to waste oxygen. I wanted to look back at Aaron and shout, "See? This is what happens when you eat copious amounts of grease." I know, not for a fact, granted, but I can take a very likely guess that there is a way to search the computer for the address which the package was sent to. It was addressed to our hostel, but since the Italian post system is so, well, Italian, they don't actually deliver. Instead, you come to pick the package up yourself. We asked for a supervisor who came over and essentially repeated everything Jabba had been saying, only with a little more empathy. Then she walked away, assumedly to go continue to do absolutely nothing but in a different location. Finally, the woman translating for me was called to the next clerk to be helped. "I'm so sorry, but I must go. Good luck." I sincerely thanked her for her efforts and then turned my attention back to Jabba. I stared at him disdainfully and then pointed to the computer. "Type. Address." "No. Is no here." "Now you speak English? Go look for my package, man. Please, please, just go look for it." "No. No inglés." I realized it was hopeless. I imagined my package sitting on a shelf in the back. It was there. It was right in front of me somewhere. This was my PayPal debit card, which was important for good reason. All of our income went into my PayPal account. The donations, money I would be making online, all of it. I would have to use my other debit card from then on, which would mean waiting 3 to 5 days for funds to transfer from PayPal to my bank account. Realizing the hopelessness of my situation, I used the only bit of Italian I could think of that seemed appropriate. "Vaffanculo, you worthless piece of shit!" As I turned to storm out of the building, I swore I saw a cheese puff fall out of his open mouth. It was the first expression of any type of emotion I'd seen since I'd walked up to his counter. Aaron and Corey had successfully mailed out our package containing the souvenirs, so we hopped on the bus and headed for Roma Termini, the central train station which would direct us towards the airport. I was angry during the ride, but calmed down quickly upon realizing we were finally leaving. This is it, I thought. No more bullshit. No more insane amounts of money spent every day. No more dealing with assholes in post offices. We were about to live like kings. I was in a state of euphoria when we reached Roma Termini and made our way to the platforms. We looked at the train schedule and found a private line headed for the airport. There was the usual discussion which happened before every single train we hopped. Aaron would pose opposition in the fear that we would be caught and reprimanded. Corey and I would both vote that we take the risk and save the crazy amount of money that trains usually cost. After several minutes back and forth, we would eventually cajole Aaron into agreeing to hop on the train without tickets. I found it especially fascinating, given the great lengths he would usually go to save money. Personally, I found it exhilarating to hop on the trains. The added suspense was just a bonus on top of saving a ton of money. This time around was no different. We eventually persuaded Aaron to hop onto the train and then sat down in some open seats. The train had made it no further than 100 yards out of the station before I saw a guy walking through the aisles with a ticket puncher. Oh, fuck. He approached us. "Biglietti?" I quickly feigned surprise. "Tickets? I thought this was a free shuttle." "No, you must have tickets." Aaron played along. A guy at the station told us this was a free train to the airport." "No. You will be fined if you don't have tickets." We tried to argue with the man, clinging to our made-up story of a man at the train station who'd told us the train was free. "You pay fine. $200 American. Aaron exploded. $200 fucking? "You pay, or I can call the police and they can arrest you at the airport." In the end, it was no use to argue. We handed the worker two $100 bills and sank back into our seats. I put my headphones on and listened to music while Corey and Aaron both did the same. None of us said a word for the rest of the ride. Once the train stopped, I went to grab my luggage and noticed a little white cabana-style hat sitting next to my bag. Everyone else had already left the train, and since it was with our luggage, I assumed it had been sitting there for quite a while. I grabbed it and walked off the train. "Check it out," I held up the hat as we walked away. "A $200 hat." Corey laughed. "There you go, bud. Hey, excuse me, train station worker guy? Do you have any lipstick? I'd like to look pretty before I get fucked." We both kept cracking jokes. Aaron was not amused. "Are you guys really joking about this?" he asked as we continued to walk towards the outside platform where we could grab a much-needed smoke. "Dude, this is just how we handle this kind of shit," I answered. "Well, I don't think it's funny. I told you guys this would happen." Corey interjected. "Aaron, you've said that every single time we hopped a train. That'd be like telling someone every day of their life that they're going to get in a car wreck if they drive, and then one day they just happen to get in one and you say, 'See, told ya. You never should have driven a car, like, ever. It doesn't work like that.'" "Yeah, well, now we just spent $200 on nothing, basically," I jumped in optimistically. "Actually, if you think about it, we still saved money in the long run. Compared to what we would have spent on tickets if we paid each time we got on a train, we probably saved a lot." Corey made another joke and we both laughed. "Just stop with the fucking jokes, okay?" Aaron snapped. "I don't want to listen to it." "You're just jealous you don't have this expensive hat to show off to your buddies back home," I said coolly as I slipped the Cuban cap on my head with a flip. "Whatever." Again, I was plagued with the thought of our continued friction as the trip continued on to its next leg. I had made up my mind that if we couldn't find a way to get along soon, I'd go my own way. Corey still had another 2 months before he was scheduled to go home, and I hoped that if I decided to split, he would come with me. I imagined continuing on with Aaron and not having Corey there to mediate between us. He was usually the middle ground, and although he did side with me on a lot of things, he was fair and generally unbiased about it. Sometimes he would disagree with me, but it never escalated. What would happen without that third party there to keep me and Aaron from being at each other's throats constantly? As we waited for our flight, I thought back on how things had changed during the past few weeks. We hadn't had the chance to get to know many of the other guests during our second stay at Hostel Happy Days. We were much too busy preparing for the upcoming flight and trying to make money. For the first time in the trip, I noticed another significant change in me. I felt alienated from the other backpackers. I watched as they went out on tours, spent their evenings drinking or going to dinners at restaurants, and generally relaxing and having a good time. I watched all of this from my bed, hidden behind my computer screen as I labored on the website and worried whether I could make enough tips from busking that evening to keep us in the black. They were busy choosing which bar to drink Peroni beer at that evening, while I was hoping I could slip an extra pastry from the grocery store for me, Corey, and Aaron to split. I was hungry virtually all the time. They counted down the days when they would have to return home from their vacation and return to school or work, while I looked with dread at my bank account and counted the days in my head until we would be reduced to true homelessness. I felt different. I felt almost angry at them for being so careless with their money and being so touristy. I once overheard one tell another that he'd had it very hard on his previous trip, quote, staying in hostels instead of hotels every night and only going out to dinner like 5 or 6 times during the whole 2 weeks. I laughed in my head. In my eyes, he looked like a tourist as he sat there in his flip-flops, eating gelato and setting down a large bag full of souvenirs next to his brand-new-looking backpack. I certainly didn't feel like a tourist. I didn't feel like a local either, though. For the first time in my life, I felt like a true traveler. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20. Food, freelancing, and botched Asian haircuts. Bangkok, Thailand. Life begins at the end of your comfort zone. Neil Donald Walsh. September 4th. Our first week in Southeast Asia was spent gorging ourselves on food and doing absolutely nothing at all in terms of seeing the sights. I started trying to get some freelance computer jobs, but that's about as far as it went. Aaron downloaded movies on his computer. Corey either video chatted with his girlfriend or messed around on Facebook. I watched pirated episodes of Seinfeld when I wasn't working on building up a freelancing profile. It was cheaper for us to buy food from street vendors or restaurants than supermarkets in Southeast Asia, so three times a day we would either walk to Silom Road, where rows of Thai food were readily available from vendors, visit a fried rice vendor right across the street, or head to the 7-Eleven that was just a couple blocks away. Food, food, food. I couldn't get enough of it after practically starving myself in Europe. I regularly return from 7-Eleven with bags of junk food. Candy bars, chips, banana muffins, weird-looking snacks with Thai writing on them that I'd never seen before. We took a special interest in the local fruit selection and became obsessed with a particularly sweet-tasting one called mangosteen. It was about double the size of a golf ball and purpley-brown in color. The outer layer was thick and spongy and inedible as far as we knew, but when this part was peeled away, it revealed a gelatinous, sugary white pulp that tasted delicious. It was an explosion of flavors, comparable to strawberries, peaches, and vanilla ice cream combined. There was also dragon fruit, which looked really awesome, a bright pink oval-shaped fruit with light green spikes all over it, but tasted disappointingly bland. We tried new foods pretty regularly, but my favorite was the fried rice vendor across the street. The stand was manned by a heavyset Thai kid, probably in his early 20s. He was a happy fellow who, it turned out, was a musician like myself and Corey. It didn't take long for us to strike up a friendship with him, and every time we approached his stand, he'd shout over the heads of the other customers, "Hey, American friends!" With a big smile, he'd motion us forward to get some food. The food everywhere we went in Thailand was incredible. I absolutely loved it. The only time I felt unsure about something was when I had bought some barbecued pork I received from a street vendor on Silom, which had the consistency of chewing gum. I worried that it was undercooked, but this didn't discourage Aaron and Corey from eating all of my share, fortunately with no ill effects. Corey even tried sushi from a street vendor one night, a risky move, I thought. Every morning, one or two of us would walk to the 7-Eleven and return with iced coffee, snacks, fruit, and cigarettes. It was all so cheap. Cigarettes were $1 a pack, which meant we weren't picking up butts off the ground and rolling them up. Most food cost about $1 a meal, and our hostel was only $2 or $3 US per night. After our first week there, we decided we really needed the rest and recuperation after our homelessness in Europe, so we opted for buying another 2 weeks. It was cheaper this way, and we had the option of our own room, which ended up being a whole dorm to ourselves because they had run out of private ones. During our first week, we became friends with a group of young guys from India who were staying in the adjacent room. They showed us the ropes around Bangkok and partied with us on several occasions. They were actually who introduced us to the mangosteen. Aaron and Corey went out on the town to see the sights during the day on several occasions. I would have loved to join, but I was on a desperate mission to start bringing in income online. The cheaper cost of living in Southeast Asia came with its own price. No more busking money. We felt it wouldn't be right to try and busk there where the average citizen was barely squeezing by to begin with. This also meant the bars weren't going to be paying more than $20 or so US for hours and hours of playing. So the answer lie with the internet. With my computer, I hoped to earn a first world income while paying for third world living expenses. This would be especially important as I would be helping to support two other people. Aaron still had some money since he'd been saving most of it back, and Corey's mom had sent him some cash, although most of it had been used right before we left Europe to replace his broken camera. neither of which was anywhere near enough money to make it another 6 or 7 months until we were scheduled to return home. Our fate was depending entirely on donations from the website at that point. We had made around $500 in donations so far from friends and family members back home. I had a feeling more of them would keep coming in, but they weren't reliable enough to depend on entirely, and it'd be nice to become completely self-sufficient. I came to realize eventually that the website itself wasn't going to be generating much money for quite some time either. It turns out that Aaron had been right all along on that one, besides the donations portion of it. I'd barely been able to put any time into it while we were in Europe, and even if I had, it would be realistically a long time before we reached the kind of readership numbers that would attract any potential advertisers or sponsors. In retrospect, I had been overwhelmingly naive and ignorant when it came to the ins and outs of website monetization. Thus, there was freelancing. The majority of my time in Bangkok was spent building freelancer profiles on websites such as Odesk or Elance. These were websites on which clients searched for freelancers to complete jobs for them, ranging in anything from graphic design to writing to voiceover work even. Basically anything you could do on a computer. There were two downsides to these websites. The first and most important was the insignificant amount of income it generated. Most freelancers on these sites are based in countries with a low cost of living, such as India or even Thailand, where I was. This means most of the jobs that pay $30 to $100 per hour in the U.S. were only paying $3 to maybe $20 on the freelancing website, the larger number being by far the less common one. Luckily, since I happen to be currently living in one of these low-income countries, this wasn't too big of a deal. I was already used to working my ass off for peanuts back on the pier in Italy. But the second downside was that it was pretty hard to get started. I needed to take a ton of skills tests, ranging from spelling and grammar to Photoshop competency. I also needed a decent portfolio, which I really didn't have at the time. I possessed two skills which to me seemed relevant enough that I could make money with them: writing and graphic design. Since writing seemed to pay the equivalent of farm labor in South Carolina circa the mid-1800s, I chose graphic design. I had essentially taught myself design a little here and there over the years, and then really started diving headfirst into it when I was building the website. In fact, virtually the only things I could muster up for a portfolio were graphics from my own personal projects. And so, while Corey lay in bed browsing Facebook and Aaron watched movies or uploaded pictures to Flickr, or when they went out with our Indian neighbors, I was sitting in front of my computer. I was on the top level of one of the bunk beds where one of the only fans in our room would gently caress me with its pitiful breeze of stale, stinky hostel air. My body was powered solely by coffee, cigarettes, and fried rice. It was excruciatingly tedious, and even more disheartening was the fact that I didn't see any results for quite a while. A rare, fortunate moment of cognitive lightning struck me at one point, which turned out to be one of several of the deciding factors that saved us from international starvation. I had joined several groups of travel bloggers on Facebook months before we even left, on the advice of a friend of mine who's also a blogger. I had posted one or two things on there and browsed a few times, but hadn't participated other than that. It suddenly occurred to me one night that most of those people probably didn't do their own graphic design work. I could charge them about half of what they were used to paying and still make considerably more than what Odesk or Elance clients were offering. Additionally, I'd be working for other bloggers who may be able to offer insight into the field I was so desperately trying to break into. So I posted something in all the groups I was a member of, offering my design services at affordable rates with a small portfolio available upon request. I got a couple of messages within the first day or two, and by the time we left Bangkok a week or so later, I had a decent bit of work coming in. These people told their friends and so on and so forth. It took a little pressure off. It still wasn't anywhere near where we needed to be financially, but it was definitely helping. It's crazy to think how quickly our lifestyle changed. Thailand was an entirely different world. One day I was scrounging for cigarette butts or sneaking around just to get a can of Coke. The next I was drinking iced coffee and smoking a Marlboro every morning, and eating a real meal whenever my heart desired. The first week or two we got a little too excited with the cheapness of everything and somehow managed to overspend. Our morning coffee trips turned into two or three coffee trips, and then we started treating ourselves to Chang beer and cheap whiskey every now and then. Surprisingly, it was me, not Aaron, who suggested we slow down a bit. Everyone agreed. One other expense that we allowed ourselves, though, was a haircut. I hadn't gotten mine cut since Isabel had done it for me in Germany. It was becoming a tangled, homelessy mess. I looked like a vagrant. Aaron took the plunge first, led by Sajir, one of our Indian friends, who took him to a barber shop down the road. I had been busy on the computer with one of my first design jobs when I went to do this, so I had to wait until the following day to get my own trim. When Aaron walked back in, I was astonished at first. He had gotten his head almost shaved and had his beard trimmed into a little goatee and mustache combo. But for some reason, the barber had shaped the goatee into a little triangle shape. He looked like a white Genghis Khan. Or, for those more familiar with famous figures from more recent years, the fucker right in the pussy guy. What? He asked with a clueless smile. You should trim your goatee, dude, I said. Why? Does it look bad? I keep looking for your fat little horse and pointy Mongol hat. Shit. He went in the bathroom and used scissors to trim it. It ended up looking fine after he shaped it up. The next day, Sajir and a couple of the other Indian guys were going to take me to a barber shop, but unfortunately it was a Sunday. Let me tell you something about Sundays in Bangkok. Every goddamn thing is closed, and I mean everything. We made it several blocks to the barber shop, where I walked in and was promptly told to leave. I'm still not sure why the people were even in there if they were closed, but I wasn't asking any questions I knew I wouldn't get a coherent answer to. Instead, Sajir started leading me to another barbershop he knew of, in the exact opposite direction, of course, near Brangrat, which was close to Silom Road. The second problem was that I was ravenously hungry by then. It had taken the better part of an hour to walk to this first place, and I was planning on grabbing lunch along the way. Nowhere was open. Now I was walking another hour and a half or so clear across town. I had become spoiled quickly during my stay in Asia and was already not used to going long stretches without eating as I had to do in Europe. After our march across town, we arrived at a janky-looking barbershop situated in an alley. I considered pausing to clarify with Sajir that I wasn't looking for a good place to buy some black tar heroin, but I decided not to judge a book by its cover. I followed him into the little shop. Upon walking in, I quickly scanned the place. On this occasion, the cover had judged the book accurately. The paint was peeling off the walls, the sinks were rusted and cracked, and the barber's scissors and combs, etc., were all kept in old rusty beer cans with the tops cut off instead of the traditional glasses filled with barbicide. There was a woman sitting behind a desk near the door with papers scattered across its surface, and behind her all the barbers sat on a bench against the wall. She pointed to a chair, and I sat down. Sajir went back to the hostel after giving me the thumbs-up sign, signifying that he had done his duty in getting me there. As I sat down, still somewhat in a daze and concernedly lightheaded from a lack of food, one of the barbers stood up from the bench. He walked over to my chair, looking somewhat annoyed, and cracked his neck. He pointed at my head. Eh? So I'd like to have it trimmed, but, like, keep the same shape, I told him. He stared back confusedly. Couldn't kautsai pasa inglit, my cub? I asked, inquiring if he understood any English. He shook his head, implying that he did not. Unfortunately, unlike Italian, I did not have a knack for speaking Thai. I had been taking Thai lessons for months even before we left and had learned a considerable deal, or so I thought. On my very first visit to the 7-Eleven upon arrival in Bangkok, I spat out a phrase in Thai and the woman just stared at me blankly. So I repeated it. Nothing. Finally, I just asked if she spoke English, and she went, "Yeah." "Oh," I'd replied. Similar conversations happened on multiple occasions, and I finally realized that almost every person there spoke English. Except, you guessed it, this particular barber and everyone in his shop. I spent the next 2 or 3 minutes trying to explain to him what I wanted, and after the most intense game of charades ever played, he seemed to understand. He let out a long sigh and then slowly made his way towards the table upon which his barber's tools were spread. He stopped halfway and motioned towards my beard, and then made a gesture with his hands, asking if I wanted to shave it. "No, no, no," I replied. "Just hair." He got out a comb and started his work. My pulse increased as I thought of our difficulty understanding each other while I described what I wanted. "What is this man about to do to my hair?" I thought. "Is he going to give me an Asian-style bowl cut? Or perhaps, in some phenomenal language miscommunication, cut off all my hair?" At that point, it was too late. He combed and combed, spraying my hair with a small water bottle as he went. Then he combed some more. I was starting to wonder if he was ever going to actually cut it. Maybe he was just planning to comb it until all the hairs fell out one by one. He combed some more. Finally, the scissors were extracted from the rusty Chang beer can in which they sat, and he lifted some hair. Snip, snip. The hair fell in what seemed like smaller tufts, and I was somewhat relieved. He kept combing. For every 10 swipes with the comb was 1 snip. He worked majestically. I started to wonder if I'd judged the man incorrectly. He moved fluidly like an Olympic ballerina, gracefully dancing through my hair. It started to take shape, and it didn't look bad. I beamed. "My God, this man is an artist." He stepped back and looked at my beard again and then pointed. "No?" he asked a second time. I could tell he wanted this beard. He was hungry for it. It was his patchy white whale. He could envision himself conquering its underwhelming glory and standing atop its ashes in a plume of smoke, his barber's scissors held high above his head like a mighty sword. "Yeah," I finally consented. "But no shave, just a trim." A smile consumed him, and he quickly placed his scissors back into the rusty Chang can and then reached for his trimmers. He used a comb and artfully shaped my shitty beard, carefully rounding every corner with exact precision. This is where the man really shined. Beards must be his forte, and he had been patiently awaiting his opportunity for showcasing. He got to my mustache and became a brain surgeon with the clippers, ever so carefully gliding the trimmers over top of the comb just below my nose. As much as my trust had grown in the man over the past 20 minutes, I was still somewhat sketched. I awaited the moment in which the trimmers dug into my skin. It never came. He paused and took a visual summary. "Damn, he pulled this thing off," I thought. The hair looked good. The beard trimming was an overwhelming success, and I was still the proud owner of 2 ears and a nose. He picked up the scissors again and carefully combed through every piece of hair, clipping any small imperfections in his work. He was my Da Vinci, and I his Vitruvian Man. I was his Fréhelisse, and he my Beethoven. He stepped back and marveled at his work. He was proud. I was proud. Then he began doing something that has thereafter made me question the competence of any barber in the States. When you're finished getting a haircut, what does the barber usually do? He takes out a brush or towel, smacks away the cut hairs from your neck, and then removes the barber's cape. You're left with an itchy back and neck for the entire remainder of the day, or until your next shower. Not this guy. He was a hair assassin. His work was perfection, no incriminating clue to be left behind. He got out the brush and swiped away. Then came a towel. Next was the brush again, this time slightly pulling the barber's cape away. Then he really blew my mind and pulled out a wet towel and covered the entire area again. Such a simple solution right in front of our faces this entire time. A wet towel. He combed again. Finally, the cape was removed and he stood with his hands on his hips, comb and scissors in hand. "Eh?" he asked. "D-Mark, I replied in awe of his excellence, Demark. This roughly translates to, very good, sir. Very good. Okay, I'll be honest with you. This is what I wish had happened. In reality, the haircut sucked. I had you going though, right? End of chapter 20. Chapter 21. The Pussy Show. Bangkok, Thailand. It's better to see something once than hear about it 1,000 times. Old Asian proverb. September 16th. Our entrance into Thailand was marked with one specific item on the agenda. Visit a pussy show, commonly referred to by Westerners as a ping pong show. You've probably seen some kind of spoof of this in a comedy movie before, where a girl is shooting ping pong balls out of her vagina at a surprised crowd and laughter ensues. Turns out this is actually a real thing, and it also turns out that ping pong ball shooting isn't the only carnival-like talent that a vagina can showcase. These are advertised in full spectacle by short little Thai men who run up to you at Pat Pong, the night market in Bangkok, and offer up flyers. I looked for, but never did find, a t-shirt that said, "My friends went to a pussy show in Bangkok and all I got was this lousy syphilis." "Ah, you American guy, you my special friend, come see pussy show. Ping pong, pickle, dart, you my special friend, you come for free." No matter how many times you say, "Get the fuck away from me, you creep," they will continue to follow you through the market, flapping their show flyer in your face repeatedly. We had been to the night market a few times, but hadn't made it to one of these shows yet. Our Indian roommates weren't too interested in joining us, and most of our recreational time had been spent throwing back Chang beers with them. I'm simply going to refer to them as the Indie Animals from now on, because damn, those dudes like to party. They were the first Indian fellows I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, and I had mixed feelings about them. On one hand, they were smelly. That probably comes as no surprise to anyone but Indian people, but it blew me away every time. We had to walk past their door on the way to our own, and every single time that smell permeated through the door and hit me in the face like a cow shit and curry-filled baseball bat. Every single time. There was one occasion when I had to go into their room for something, and I swear I thought I was going to pass out. On the other hand, though, they were really nice, helpful, and some of the friendliest people I've ever met. I trusted them almost right away and had no qualms leaving the room with them sitting next to my computer or phone. They were great guys, and I considered them great friends, although they may have been a little too friendly at times. A lot of this has to do with the stark cultural differences between our two countries. For one, in America, if you're walking around holding hands with another man, people will 100% think you're a homosexual. In India, it would be akin to seeing Bob and Bill hold their hand on the way to the car after slamming back a few buds and throwing some darts. A simple show of friendship. In American terms, kind of like a fist bump or a high five. The first time we saw them doing it, though, we were very confused. There was much whispering among us as to what was going on. "Dude, you saw them holding hands, right? Are they gay? 'Cause I thought Sajir had like a girlfriend back home." Finally, Corey just asked one of them, and he filled us in. None of us have any problem with gay people, for the record. We were just very, very curious as to what was happening. The, quote, "gay agenda, it's spread to India, somebody shipped some Bibles." Just kidding. Anyway, there was Sajir, who I've already spoken about a little bit. He was a tall guy in his mid-20s with a small goatee, who always had a pair of aviators on, it seemed. He was the Fonz of the group, laid back and chill. Then there was Jamshad, or Jam as we all called him. I had the hardest time understanding him out of any of them. He spoke English almost as if he was underwater. I had to have him repeat almost everything he said multiple times. This was made especially humorous one day when I asked him what he did for a living in Bangkok. "I teach English." Dear God. He was a shorter guy with short, curly hair and a baby face. He was a little more intense than the other guys. In reference to my comment above about being a little too friendly, He kissed me on the cheek as I was playing guitar one night. He was exceptionally drunk and chipper, and laid his head on my shoulder where he proceeded to say over and over, "You are my bosom friend." I had to kindly tell him afterwards that this was not socially acceptable in my culture, or at least that I wasn't comfortable with it. Did I mention the smell? He was very understanding and apologized profusely, although I assured him I wasn't upset about it. Then there was the third indie animal, Prayful, whom everyone just called Matthew. Actually, we usually didn't call him anything because it was more common for a Browns player to walk home with a Super Bowl ring than it was for that kid to open his mouth and talk. He was definitely the most reserved of the group. There were a few other guys that came and went during our time in Bangkok, but these three were the ones that stick in my mind. Flash forward a couple weeks to the night of the pussy show. The indie animals declined the invitation to join, as I mentioned earlier. We told them we could have a little party when we returned in a few hours. They, of course, had no objections to partying. So we walked to Pat Pong in search of a pussy show. When I say in search of, what I mean is we made it about 20 feet into the market before one of the little flyer guys ran up to us. "Pussy show! Pussy show! American friend, you come free!" "All right then," Corey said. "Lead the way, bud." He was taken aback, as if thinking, "Holy shit, that actually worked finally." We followed him through an alley and arrived at the venue. Surprisingly, the door wasn't hidden somewhere dark and mysterious like you'd expect, but rather right there in the open. You could literally watch a girl shoot things out of her pussy and then walk right out and buy a $2 elephant statue for your mom back home. He opened the door and we followed him up a narrow set of stairs. When we reached the top level, we came into a dark room, much similar to a strip club. There was a stage in the middle with a large staircase leading up to it. Behind it was a bar, manned by the largest Thai woman I have ever seen. The room was surrounded with benches and small stadium-style seats. A scantily clad woman danced on the stage. Several other women, equally provocative, either hung out in the front of the bar or sat on the small steps. We were shown to a bench. "You sit here." And with that, our guide was gone, walking back down the stairs to search for more customers, presumably. I was already feeling weird about the situation. We were the only customers in the whole place. One of the girls approached us in a thong but no top. "Drink for my friend?" Her little boobs jiggled as she spoke, and I tried not to be a pig and stare. Then I quickly realized I was sitting in a place where women shot things at me with their genitals, so I let my eyes wander a little more guiltlessly. "Yeah, drink," Aaron replied. We all agreed, and soon the girl returned with three Chang beers. We thanked her, but she didn't leave. Instead, she sat down with Aaron and began rubbing his leg. "You're cute. You buy me Coke?" "No," Aaron replied. I was sensing sinful motives by the girl. Soon, Corey and I had girls sitting next to us as well, and all asking for a Coke. We ignored them as politely as we could while the stage was being prepared. After a few minutes, Deep Blue Something's Breakfast at Tiffany's started to play over the speakers. I was both humored and intrigued by the queer song selection. An announcer came on the loudspeaker shouting Thai, much similar to what you'd hear at a boxing or wrestling match. A girl walked on the stage, completely nude. We quickly decided that any other girls who had bottoms on were probably ladyboys, whom were pretty hard to discern from real women sometimes. If this woman was a ladyboy, they had given her a bionic vagina instead of a regular one. She promptly sat down on the stage, inserted a full dill pickle into herself, and with a "hump," shot it straight out of her crotch at us. It bounced across the floor towards me while I quickly dodged what I can only assume was a pickle covered in STDs. The girl sitting next to me laughed and said, "Ah, you scared, you scared." "Goddamn right I'm scared." She placed another pickle in her vagina just as another group of people were walking in the door. "Hump!" It shot across the room at them and they all jumped back to escape it. They were ushered to a bench diagonally across from us. "Huh!" Another pickle shot out across the floor. She was spinning in circles and shooting them in all directions as fast as she could manage. Another girl was walking around with a bucket and tongs and placing the pickles in it. She held one up at Corey's face as she walked by. "Ah!" she exclaimed with a laugh as he jumped backwards. The girls we were sitting with all continued to laugh at us. The pickle girl left and another woman took her place. This one began pulling a long string of razor blades out of her vagina. We were aghast. "What?" I heard Aaron scream as she pulled the blades out one by one on a string. This was followed by another string, but with small flowers. Ah, we all sighed in relief. This girl then pulled out a big permanent marker. We stared inquisitively. What's she going to do next? The marker was inserted exactly where you guessed, I'm sure, with the tip sticking out. She sat a piece of paper on the floor and squatted over it while moving her hips around in a controlled circular motion. Then she humped forward a couple of times and did a little swoop motion with her ass. We stared virtually on the edge of our seats. She held up the paper, which now bore a perfect smiley face. I couldn't have drawn the thing better with my hand, let alone if someone shoved a Sharpie up my ass. We all clapped. She bowed, pen still in place. The girl sitting next to me started rubbing my leg. I swatted her hand away and took another swig of my beer. Then I thought to myself, I wonder if this beer is drugged. Oh, well. She reached again and then this time slid her hand up my shorts leg. I swatted harder. No! I bet you a big dick, yeah? It's tiny. I feel it and find out. She started trying to rub my crotch through my pants. I grabbed her arm again. Seriously, I'm not interested. Thanks, but no. You no fun. I sucky for 1,000 baht, she said. I thought for a moment. First, I wondered if there had been any recent advances in curing herpes, AIDS, or any of the other you're-stuck-with-it types of diseases. I thought to myself, damn, that's actually a pretty good deal. I mean, seriously, that's like 26 American dollars. I could get a blowjob from this girl for less money than a parking spot in New York. Then I thought of my family doctor back home and his words as I would drop trow in his office. I see what you got going on here. Looks like a hooker sucked you off, huh? What you're seeing there is actually your penis detaching from your body. You see, the hooker spit has lodged itself up under your shaft there, and it's causing your cock to eat itself from the bottom up. I gotta show this to my secretary. Hey, Carol, come in and look at this guy's dick. Oh my God, is there anything you can do? Well, there's a couple ways you can take care of it. Your best bet's going to be flying back to Thailand and killing the hooker who gave it to you. That would stop its power source. Or we can try injecting some Catholic girl spit in there along with the hooker saliva and let the two just duke it out. That procedure's a little riskier. I mean, odds are the Catholic girl's blowjob is going to be nowhere near as good as someone more experienced like a hooker. Blowjob for 1,000 baht, she repeated, snapping me out of my trance. Thanks, but I'm going to have to pass. Corey directed his girl over to us by telling her that he had a girlfriend, but that Aaron and I were both interested. Aaron's girl gave up on him pretty early on, probably in fear of the whole Catholic spit thing destroying her. A new girl walked onto the stage as we continued to fight off the prostitutes. The previous acts approached us as much to the cattiness and dismay of the current lingerers. Every female in this place was a working girl, it seemed, aside from the big woman behind the bar, who I assumed worked as a semi-truck when she wasn't supervising the pussy show. The new performer held a long, thin tube between her fingers on one hand and inserted it into her vagina. She lifted one leg high in the air, raised her hips, and yelled out a short but high-pitched, "Nah!" A balloon popped. She was shooting a blowgun out of her vagina. We applauded heavily. Pop! Another balloon exploded amidst cheers from the small audience. She kept going and hit 9 out of 10 balloons before missing. I was thoroughly impressed. Soon after the balloons were popped, she walked off stage and headed our way. Our previous hooker entourage had finally given up and headed to the bar during her performance. I mean, how could they compete with that? Hi, hi, cutie boy. I suck for 1,000 baht, she offered, jerking her hand near her mouth and sticking her tongue in her cheek. Universal 8th grade sign language for a blowy. Enough about the blowjob, I replied, waving my hand in dismissal. How the fuck did you learn to do that with your vagina? Many years, long time practice. You know sucky? No. She turned around and walked away just as another girl got up on the stage with a small glass bottle of soda. She shook it up and sat it in front of her. She spit on her hand and rubbed herself quickly and then slowly sat over the bottle, holding the bottom of it with her feet. She paused for a moment. The small crowd went silent. And then, pop! She snapped her hips backward and the bottle top popped off, sending soda flying into the air. My jaw dropped, as did everyone else's. Are you fucking kidding me? I heard Corey comment, astonished. Oh my God! Aaron was taken aback. I was speechless. We all clapped and cheered. About that time, the mountain of a woman who had been behind the bar approached us. Show over, time you go, she barked. Okay. Aaron looked over at us, all equally puzzled. We all stood up. 500 baht each. Huh? I was incredulous. We'd only had one beer, about 60 baht each. 500 baht, you pay now. The guy that brought us here said it was free, Corey inputted. No free, you pay 500 baht each. Aaron started to pull money from his pocket and I stopped him. No, dude, don't fucking give her anything. I looked back at the big woman and told her flat out, we're not paying 500 baht each. It's not going to happen. 300 baht. 300 baht each, then. No, no 300 baht. You buy coke for girl? No. You? She looked at Corey and Aaron. They both shook their heads. Then 300 baht. All the women had gathered around us in a big circle with the big mama-san towering over them. They all started yelling out toward us in frustration behind her. You no buy coke! I was confused, as were Corey and Aaron. What the hell was this fascination with buying them cokes? Were they working on commission of some kind? 100 baht each, Aaron jumped in to counteroffer. No, no 100 baht. You pay 300 baht each. She stepped forward and a few of the girls behind her began hurling insults towards us as they threw up their arms. It looked like a riot was about to ensue. Fine, fine, we'll give you 300 fucking baht. I motioned to Aaron, who counted out the money and handed it to her. Now you leave. Show over, the mama-san demanded. We quickly made our way to the exit, feeling very uncomfortable and uneasy. After exiting the show, we quickly decided that 30 bucks or so was well worth it for seeing all that, and our mood improved. Aaron suggested we pick up some whiskey to take back to the hostel. I'm not much of a liquor drinker, so I opted for a 4-pack of Chang, while he and Corey grabbed 2 bottles of cheap rot-gut liquor and some mixers. Aaron popped open the whiskey on the steps outside of the 7-Eleven and mixed Corey and himself up a drink for the long walk home. As we walked, he sipped on the drink and gradually added more whiskey to the Coke bottle he was drinking from. About a block from the hostel, he was already beginning to get a little wobbly. Aaron, you might want to slow down on that stuff a little bit, bud, Corey suggested. It'll sneak up on you. I'm good, man. I sip on this stuff all the time at home. He was chipper and uppity, which made me think he was getting a pretty good buzz going. He didn't seem to care about anything. I think I like drunk Aaron better than sober Aaron, I thought. All right, man. Just saying, Corey continued. Your tolerance is probably fucked now considering how little we've drank over the past couple months. I'll be all right, Aaron insisted. We made it back to the hostel without getting smashed by one of the many rickety buses careening around the city and were greeted by the indie animals as we walked in. Party, party, Sajir smiled as we made our way up the steps to our rooms. Yeah, party, Aaron cheered. I cracked open one of the Changs and had a seat on one of the beds when we entered our room. The indie animals ran into their own room and came back shortly with more alcohol and some food. Aaron sat on the floor and mixed up another drink. I noticed that the first bottle of whiskey was almost completely gone. Aaron, you might want to have some of that food, I suggested. he was starting to look incredibly intoxicated. It was a quick transformation. Yeah, bro, that's probably not a bad idea if you're planning on making it through the night. Seriously, Corey chimed in. What? I'm not even drunk yet. You guys ain't seen me get drunk before, he said. I swear his eyes crossed as he was telling me that. He was pissed drunk. Whatever you say, dude, I laughed. At the behest of Jamshad, we got out the instruments and started playing some tunes. Aaron, giggling and shouting as we played, suddenly widened his eyes with a smile. He jumped and rummaged through his bag, finally returning with the little Jaws harp that Pablo had given him. Corey and I glanced at each other. That fucking Jaws harp. After Pablo had gifted the small instrument to him, he'd spent hours in the nature preserve practicing it, and some more time whittling a case for it out of wood. He absolutely loved the thing. Pee, pong, pow, ping, ping, pang, pow, pow, pow. Endlessly we'd hear that thing, quite possibly one of the most annoying sounds in the world, panging away in the camp. We contemplated stealing it and tossing it into the woods on multiple occasions. He sat down and started panging away on it as Corey and I played. Ping, ping, pow, pow, ping, ping, pang, pang. Then he was shouting again, cheering belligerently as he rocked back and forth and lolled his head from side to side. Sajir! Sajir, I fucking love you, dude! Take a shot with me! Corey and I thought it was hilarious. Aaron, this is the most fun I've seen you have this whole trip. You just need to stay drunk for the rest of your life. We all laughed. Corey and I played some more tunes, and after a while I looked up to see Aaron on the floor, rolling around and shouting. Woo! Yeah! Fuck, yeah! Then he sat up quickly. His head tipped forward and his eyes drooped. Suddenly he stood up and then immediately fell onto a bed frame. He stumbled the other way, and the little oscillating fan in the middle of the room tottered precariously. Then the vomiting began. He spewed whiskey and coke across the room with a velocity that I didn't even think possible for a human. He was like an inebriated dragon, attempting to burn down our village with liquid fire. He even flapped his arms uncontrollably like little drunk dragon wings. Blah! He shot his whiskey fire vomit across the room as he stumbled, took flight majestically, towards the bathroom. The music stopped and everyone collectively gasped. We all jumped up and ran into the bathroom where Aaron was already sitting on the toilet with his head in his hands. Corey and I grabbed a hold of him. Dude, are you going to be all right? I asked with a bit of a laugh. Woo! He held up one of his hands as he attempted to keep his little party going. Better get him some water, Corey suggested to me. He had his hand on Aaron's back as Aaron leaned forward. I sprinted to one of the beds and grabbed a bottle of water off of it, then ran back to the bathroom. Aaron was on the floor, completely covered and surrounded by vomit, and Corey was standing in the corner with a look of pure confusion and horror on his face. How the fuck? What just happened? I asked. I was gone maybe 3 seconds. Dude, he just tipped and I don't know. I really don't know. The indie animals were all laughing their asses off. Okay, Corey and I were too. I'd be lying if I said we didn't snap a bunch of pictures before picking Aaron up from his puke bath. We must get him into the shower, Sajir suggested. He and Corey picked Aaron up by the arms and legs and carried him to the big shower stall adjacent to the toilet room. They gently laid him on the floor and prayful Matthew began spraying him with the water hose. Aaron stirred a little. Eventually, we were standing in the bathroom, calmly carrying on a full conversation while prayful Matthew held the hose over Aaron. Every once in a while, he would groan and roll over a bit. Then, suddenly, he sprung to life. More vomit erupted from his mouth like a fire hose and shot past prayful Matthew, still holding the hose in bewilderment. He was shouting and making weird noises as he crawled on the shower floor. Everyone was shouting and attempting to avoid the vomit sprinkler as he flung himself around on the floor like a fish on bath salts. Finally, he sank down and passed out again. We all calmly resumed conversation and Prayful Matthew started holding the hose over him again. "You need cultured cream and crackers," Jam suggested in his thick underwater accent. "Make him not drunk anymore." "What the fuck is culture cream?" Corey asked. "Are you guys gonna, like, jizz on a cracker and make him eat it?"
"What is jizz?" Jam asked.
Corey and I laughed. "Really, what is culture cream?" I asked.
"Cream with bacteria," he clarified.
"So again, jizz?"
"Culture of milk. Matthew will show you if you go to the store with him. But you must show me what this jizz is later."
I volunteered to run to the 7-Eleven with Prayful Matthew, who handed the sprayer to Corey before leaving. We ran across the street and through the alleyways to reach the store as quickly as we could. When we walked in, Prayful Matthew walked straight over to the cooler and pulled out a cup of yogurt.
"Oh," I realized what Jam was talking about.
"Really? Yogurt and crackers for a drunk cure? It's a new one for me." We hurriedly ran back to the hostel. Corey was still spraying down Aaron with the cold water in an attempt to sober him up and clean him off.
"Okay, we must get him into the bed," Sajir offered.
He and Corey grabbed Aaron under the arms and lifted him again. Just as they did this, Aaron woke up and shouted,
"No! I can do it. I can do it."
He stood there for approximately 1.5 seconds. Then he fell. I use the term fell very loosely here, for it was more of a fling. It looked like he attempted to backflip through the floor. He quickly whipped backwards on the slick shower floor and slammed his head and back into the tiles. We collectively gasped.
"Oh!"
Question. "Why did we just let him do that?" Corey wondered aloud. This time, when Aaron claimed he could do it by himself, he was firmly ignored. We finally got him to his bed where we tried to lay him down. He kept sitting up, so we attempted to feed him the yogurt and crackers. It was a blunder, and he wound up with cracker crumbs all over his bed and the floor, and a white ring of yogurt all around his mouth. Corey pointed to it and then looked at Jam and the other indie animals. "Jizz." Soon after this, the indie animals all went back to their room, and Corey and I were left to babysit Aaron, who didn't want any part of going to sleep. The puking continued, probably 100 times or more, it seemed, and he soon ended up back on the bathroom floor, rolling about and moaning. Corey and I were exhausted from taking care of him all night. Any kind of buzz we may have had had been ruined long before. We finally just gave up and left him on the bathroom floor, assured that he was sufficiently hydrated and out of immediate harm's way. He didn't show any signs of alcohol poisoning, fortunately, so we felt comfortable just leaving him be for the time being. Eventually, at some point during the night, he migrated to his bed. The next day he awoke bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. At some point, around 9 or 10 in the morning, the cleaning lady arrived for her daily room cleanup. I had just woken up when I saw her walk in. She rounded the corner and was seized in terror. The mop and her jaw both hit the floor. The entire floor was covered in a lake of vomit. The fan lay overturned in the middle of it. Bottles and cans were strewn about, and a container of fried rice had exploded on the wall. She made uncomfortable, high-pitched gasps as she precariously walked around the vomit and went into the bathroom. "Ah!" I heard her scream as if she saw a spider or something. She had discovered the toilet room. Puke was on the walls, all over the floor, even on the back of the toilet. It was on the door and the door handle. There was loose toilet paper strewn about within the slop. A trail of vomit led to the shower room where there was more puke. It was truly unbelievable that such a volume of liquid could come out of one person. About 1/10 of it had made it into the trash can. "No, no, no." She quickly walked back out of the bathroom, past the mop and cleaning supplies, and exited the room. She returned a short time later, stopped and stared at the mess as she slowly picked up her mop. Aaron had woken up just as she was leaving the first time. Now he walked up to her.
"I'll clean this. Don't worry about it."
I was expecting some type of conversation to happen, but
the woman simply handed him the mop and turned around and left. "So, Aaron," Corey innocently spoke, "remember when you bitched at us for staying up all night drinking in Italy at that campground hostel? I don't ever want to hear you bitch about us drinking again." He laughed as he mopped up the mess. "Yeah, that's